morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to do something that may be a bit unexpected. We began this program way back in, I think it was June of last year, now over 6 months ago, presenting the Genesis account as it is presented in the Torah. And so we began at the beginning of the Torah, considering what Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, said about creation. And we spent better part of 2 months kind of systematically going through the initial statements that God made relative to creation. And we did that for a number of reasons. One of the reasons that we did that is that it's a marvelous introduction to Scripture, because it's the creation account that is the most consistently attacked a part of the Torah by socialist secular humanists. You know, if you've been educated in the last 20 years, you've been told that the quote-unquote biblical account, the biblical creation account, is has a mythical God creating the heavens and the earth in 6 days, which is absolutely nonsense, since we know that the earth is in the range of 15 billion years old. So not the earth, but the universe is in the age of, range of 15 billion years old. And so it is most often used to discredit the Torah. I don't think there's any account in the Torah that's used more often to discredit the Torah than that one. The flood account is most often ascribed to a retelling of a Babylonian myth. And what's interesting with both of these two accounts is that Yah's creation account is totally and completely accurate. I mean, absolutely, precisely accurate. It is true that it took God exactly 6 24-hour Earth days to create the heavens and the earth to get us to where we are now. And it is true that the universe was created some 15, 16 billion years ago. Both are true, and all you have to do to understand them is understand relativity. And we will go back to the scriptural account of creation so that we can impress the reliability of the Torah and provide a means for everyone to understand its account. But more than that, the Torah's Genesis account is also a three stories in one, where we find God telling us the future history of mankind, and also him imprinting his means to reconcile his relationship with us over that same period of time. But it's just like the Gabilovish epic as it relates to Noah and the flood. What you find is if you actually read the epic, there isn't any nexus between the two stories. 99% of what is on the tablets relative to the Babylonian story has no counterpart in the scriptural account. I mean, it's literally 99%. Everything that's important in the Babylonian story has no counterpart in the scriptural account. And everything that's important in the scriptural account has no counterpart in the Babylonian myth. And yet, because of the nexus of about three somewhat irrelevant concepts, it's considered to be a retelling of the same story by the same socialist secular humanist that was to discredit the Torah. So we're going to get into that story as well. We're also going to talk about the Garden of Eden and allay a lot of the myths that are associated with the Garden of Eden, as well as focus on what we can learn there that is germane to our understanding of the covenant and of how religion works to lead people away from the covenant. Now, since we reviewed this material now some 6 months ago, I think it's going to be important, rather than to just jump in where we left off, to go back to the beginning and to recover some of the same territory. And so that you know, the reason that we got off track in terms of presenting this and spent months just covering God's perspective on his Torah is that the phone calls to the program and letters that I received from listeners were almost universally such that they said, you know, what we need here is a foundation. We need before we get to God's perspective on life, on the universe, on why he created the universe, why we exist, on why we're he's talking about this covenant relationship, and how do we know his name, and how do we relate to this book where these stories are being told, which is in the Torah. Bereshit is the first book of the Torah. We misnamed it Genesis. We really need a foundation upon which to stand, and we need a perspective to understand God's view of these things. And so we spent many months just considering the statements that Yahweh himself made in the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, as well as the Proverbs, on his Torah. What Torah represented, which is teaching, guidance, direction. What the covenant represented, how we can engage in this covenant relationship with Yahweh. Why we know that God's name is Yahweh. How we know that when he diminished an aspect of himself and set that aspect, that manifestation, apart from himself and became corporeal, that the name of that mission was Yahusha, Yahweh saves. And so we went through these things, and we went through an analysis of what are the cracks in Christianity. Where are the strokes of the Christian dogma counterfeit, and examined Pauline doctrine and how it's incompatible with Yah's Torah teaching. And also, because we celebrated Teruah, which is the harvest, where we are asked to shout out a warning to those who are on a religious or political path, that those paths lead away from God. And reconciliations, where we're invited to come into the presence of our spiritual mother, so that our relationship with God can be reconciled. And we celebrated Sukkah, which is the time we get to camp out with God. We devoted weeks of programs to those three meetings where we were invited into God's presence. So we've now laid a foundation. We've provided a overall view from which to stand to have a proper perspective of Yah's testimony. That done, I would now like to return to the Genesis account. After all, this is the Genesis Communication Network. It makes sense that we start where God started, which is at the beginning, with his testimony to us. And so with that, over this these next days and weeks and months, we are going to systematically make our way through what Yahweh, God's one and only name, had to say to us in the opening volume of his Torah. What we're going to consider, Yahweh revealed to Moshe on Mount Horeb, now nearly 3,500 years ago. And it is it's an astonishing look, not only into the nature of our Creator, who he is, and what he wants to achieve, but also how we came to be. And this path, which I've shared with you, is going to begin with the creation of the universe and with Earth, and then the creation of life, and then it's going to migrate through the story of Adam and Chawa in the Garden of Eden, because there are many lessons to be learned there, and then move on to when the flood actually occurred, where the flood occurred, and what the purpose of the flood was. And that's going to be a fascinating review. I can promise you that those of you who stay with us and listen to that story will be amazed at what you learn. And from there, we're going to turn to the single most important writings that exist in the entirety of the universe, and that is Yahweh's presentation of his covenant relationship to Abram, who became Abraham. Because there we're going to learn the five terms and conditions of the covenant that we too have to embrace and act upon if we wish to do as Abram did, which is to engage in a relationship with God. And we will learn the five benefits of the covenant, the promises that God makes to his covenant children, and how we receive each of those benefits. One of the things that you will learn is that God's goal is not to save us. This religious myth that we should be seeking salvation is not God's priority. God's interested in us choosing to engage in a relationship with him on the terms and conditions he has delineated. And then, as a benefit of that relationship, those children who embrace that relationship and get to know him, he then, as a byproduct of that relationship, saves. And he has a very specific way of doing it, and we will discuss that as well. So with that preamble, let's begin at the beginning with a review of the Genesis account, which in Scripture, in Hebrew, is actually a Bereshith. It is perhaps the most important and least understood prophetic passage in the whole of Yah's testimony. It means in the beginning. It's found in Genesis 1. Yahweh not only introduces himself, he explains the creation process, and he presents his plan of reconciliation all in this same story, giving us the framework from which to understand his prophetic timeline. In addition to these three essential stories, all embedded in God's initial testimony, creation, our reconciliation, and pre-recorded history, Yahweh also answers mankind's most important questions. Why do we exist? There really is no more important question that we can ask. Why do we exist? Other than perhaps, does God exist? And if he does exist, how do we come to know him? And since those questions are actually related, if you come to know that God exists, and through this prophetic journey that we're going to take through history in the Genesis account, God's going to prove that he exists. Absolutely prove beyond any reasonable doubt that he exists by the exacting testimony that he provides not only of our creation, but also of future history. He proves that he authored these words because only a being that is not constrained by time could have presented this story. Only an eyewitness to creation and an eyewitness to the culmination of human history could have inspired the words that we're going to read. So he proves his existence. But then once you know that he exists, the next question is, who is he? What is he like? And what does he want? And so that parlays directly into the what does he want is got to relate to why do we exist? And all of these questions are answered in the Torah. And they're all answered in the opening salvo of the Torah, which is this book called Bereshith, in the beginning. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. More after the commercial break. To Shattering Myths. We are turning our attention to the creation account so that we come to understand why God created the universe. We come to understand who he is and understand why we exist. And in that light, we have a creation thought from Jason, who is calling in from Pennsylvania. Good morning, Jason. How are you?
Good morning, Yada. Bless you. It sounds like both you guys got a little bit of that flu going around, so...
I do indeed.
You. Yeah, bless you guys, and may Yah shine upon you and heal you real quick. So, I want to say really fast, you know, I've sparred with atheists. I've done my best to try and wake them up because I'm younger, you know, I'm 28, and I've known a lot of atheists. So I've tried to spar with them, and there's one thing that you can say to them, and I use this frequently, and I just thought this was a good thought to kick off what you're going to be doing with your study. This is the one statement that they have never been able to come back at me with anything. I basically, you know, just say, think about this. What is the scientific statistical probability of something coming from nothing? How about that?
Yeah, of course it's nothing, zero.
Exactly.
Yeah, but. But so is the statistical probability of life emerging and being able to reproduce itself and nourish itself.
So true.
Out of inorganic materials. In fact, the kind of the foremost authorities on the subject of the spontaneous generation of life came to the conclusion that it is more likely for a tornado to go over a junkyard of broken, dilapidated cars and appliances in the Midwest, and in the midst of that tornado, construct a fully capable 747. Than it is for life to have spontaneously generated. And so the argument was that life came to be because even the improbable, given enormous periods of time, becomes a possible. But, of course, the Cambrian period proved that that was not the case, that within 5 million years, not billions of years, of the time that it was possible, based upon our atmosphere and the overall conditions on Earth, that the oceans were no longer boiling. We didn't have volcanoes erupting everywhere on the globe. We weren't continually being bombarded by asteroids. The moment that it became possible for life to exist on Earth, all 20-some-odd phyla or forms of life that exist today came to exist spontaneously, instantly, at one time. And so there was not an elongated period of time, and there wasn't an evolution between basic body styles. They all came to exist at the same moment.
Right.
And so that alone is sufficient. So what they have done is said, all right, we recognize that there is no chance of life coming from nothing, and all experiments, by the way, which were prevalent throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, trying to prove that life spontaneously combusted upon the planet, they've all been ceased. There's no funding for any of them anymore because it's an impossibility. And
right.
So then they moved to, well, then what happened was that life was created on another planet where they had a longer period of time to have the improbable happen, and then it rode into to Earth on an asteroid. And then the asteroid thing, well, that doesn't work because the heat on the asteroid is way too hot that by the time it entered the atmosphere it would be evaporated. So then they came up with the idea, well, it rode in on a comet, and the comet then supplied all the water on Earth, came by way of a comet interacting with the Earth, and it came by way of the comet. I mean, it's so desperate that it, I don't know if you watch the South Park episode on Mormonism, where they constantly play the drum beat in the background, dum 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 dum.
I heard about
dum.
That.
Yeah, that's my reaction to all of this. And
absolutely.
Then you go one step further, and that is that if you go back to the 1950s, 95% of scientists believed that the universe had always existed. There wasn't a single creationist amongst scientists in the 1950s. But then Hubble discovered the redshift and found that the universe was expanding, and based upon extrapolating it expanding, it had to have a place where it began.
Right.
And they came up with the concept of the Big Bang, which is the term that Yah himself uses in his Genesis account.
Absolutely.
And since that time, every scientist now has adopted what God originally said, which is that the universe was in fact created. And so science is consistently moving towards what Yah's position is. We have to go to the break. I'll just leave you with one last thought, Jason, and that is that what we're going to do is we're going to debunk the myths of secular humanism while we pronounce the truth that Yahweh has conveyed to us. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. The last thought that I left with Jason is that the goal here is not to spar or debate with atheists. I don't care that an atheist holds their point of view. They're welcome to it. I don't care if an agnostic holds their point of view. I think to be an atheist requires way too much effort, way too much faith. But if you wish to be an atheist, that's fine. You wish to be an agnostic, that's fine. I don't even care if you want to be a Christian. I do care when you start promoting these myths as being true and you try to persuade others to embrace them, then I've got a problem, because what you're doing is you're leading people astray. But so long as you want to hold them, that is certainly fine. That's what free will is all about. That's why every radio in this country and around the world, and why every internet browser allows you to make a choice. You can choose to listen to this program, or you can listen to others. Now, returning to the creation account, you should know that it's not uncommon for God to paint several pictures with the same brush. For example, when one reads the story of Abraham taking Yishak, which, by the way, means laughter. It's so funny. I was talking to Scott at the during the break that one of my favorite stories happens to be that Abraham and Sarah got so comfortable with God, who ate with them, drank with them, walked with them, talked with them, spent considerable time with them. They became, which is the whole nature of the covenant, they became so comfortable with God that when God told them that they were going to have a child, they just laughed. I mean, she was, 90 years old, he was 100 years old, and they just bust out laughing. And so God, rather than say, how dare you laugh at my face, how dare you laugh at my my promises, God didn't get mad. He just has a sense of humor. He said, okay, when your child is born, you can name him Laughter. Yishak, Isaac, is the Hebrew word for laughter. Anyway, the story of Abraham taking laughter to Mount Moriah. Moriah means to revere Yah. Within the context of this opening salvo of the Torah in Bereshith, with a little knowledge of archaeology and history, it becomes immediately apparent that the story chronicles an actual event, that he actually went to this very place and did this very thing, and this is the his way of confirming his willingness to participate in the Torah, and not only just in the Torah, but in the covenant. And when that story, though, is juxtaposed to what happened 2,000 years later, exactly 2,000 years later, in 33 CE, in exactly the same place on Mount Moriah, it's obvious that it was painting a prophetic picture, a dress rehearsal, if you will, for the Masiyah sacrifice, precisely in the same place, 40 Yobel, 40 Yobel is 2,000 years later, and it was a dress rehearsal for Pesach, for Passover. And all of the story parallels that one. So it's a prophetic picture of what is going to happen and why it's going to happen, where Yahweh himself tells Abraham, don't worry, I'm going to provide the lamb. And so, so many of God's stories depict actual events. The Exodus is another example of this. It predicts and depicts an actual event where God himself with Moshe went into Mitzrayim, today's Egypt, and rescued his children and led them out to his home in the Promised Land. It's a real story. But that story is also a presentation in history of what Passover represents, and how it is the doorway to life. It is the story of what unleavened bread represents, of the removal of yeast and therefore sin from our bodies, so that we can engage and endure with God, so that we can be in his presence and walk with him. And it is a living testament to the power of Bukurim, where we become God's children. And then to Shavuah, where we are empowered, enriched by our Heavenly Father along this journey. And so these are stories that are historically accurate, as is the creation account, but they're also prophetic of what is to come, and they're instructive in terms of us trying to understand Yah's schedule. As a matter of fact, all of these things, particularly the creation account, predict God's meeting times and tell us specifically when God is going to interact with us in a way to fulfill his promises. It is the story of man's salvation, if you will, past, present, and future. So there are three timelines and three simultaneous narratives that are embedded in this account that we're going to study first. Bereshith, in the beginning, Genesis 1. But the brushstrokes are much broader, they're much bolder, they're much more complex than they are in some of these stories that we have just considered. So, as is his custom, Yahweh chooses his colors for a reason, and he shades each word with great precision. So we will honor the universal artist by examining his selections under a microscope of Hebrew lexicon. neocons. We're going to amplify his testimony so that we come to see all of the fine brushstrokes and all of the colors that he chose. As is the format of these volumes that we're going to be reviewing, I'm going to share the insights his testimony has revealed to us, and I'm going to connect this painting to others this artist, the ultimate artist, has drawn. If anything else, my commentary will slow you down, hopefully, cause you to reflect on the majesty of our Maker's world and his word, and perhaps help you make the connections that are the principal ingredient from going, from transitioning from knowing to understanding. However, be forewarned. This chapter about our existence, I am now turning to what's called the Haya chapter in Yadaya. Yadaya means to know Yah. It requires a level of complexity in the midst of what is already an extremely challenging and interwoven tapestry. To comprehend the creative side of Yah's testimony, there's going to have to be at least some acknowledgement of the theory of relativity. We're going to have to discuss some attributes of physics. Going to have to delve a bit into the world of astronomy, not astrology, but astronomy, biology, and evolution. And we're going to discuss, to some degree, the fossil record. We're going to discuss statistical analysis so that you understand probability. And you can equate probability to reasoning and thus to conclusions. And we will also have to come to evaluate the concept of space-time, and particularly the nature of light, which is pure energy, and where on a photon of light, time simply is. Time exists. The past, present, and future exist simultaneously on a photon of light. So I'm going to do my best to provide the insights for those who may be somewhat uninitiated in these concepts, while not boring the scientists or overwhelming those who have a limited interest in these particular discoveries. But no matter where you reside on the spectrum of contemporary scientific awareness, I beg your indulgence. What lies before you is challenging, but it's worth the investment of our time. Now, before we begin, there's some good news. Yahweh is correct. From his perspective, it took precisely 6 24-hour days to create the universe, our planet, life, and mankind. And scientists are right as well. Looking back from our perspective, the universe is somewhere between 10 and 20 billion years old. Yahweh is correct in that plants and animals reproduce after their kind, and evolutionists are accurate in saying that some species have evolved. Yahweh not only agrees with the concept of the Big Bang, he was the first to use the term. God even uses scientific jargon in his presentation of dinosaurs and of relativity. And in this regard, his testimony is in complete harmony with the fossil record. Therefore, this scientific review of Bereshith in the beginning isn't going to pit religious creationism against the Big Bang and evolution, but instead demonstrate that the Torah and science agree, right down to the details, at least where the facts are known and science is rational. The controversy only rages between the advocates of religious and socialist secular humanists who advocate all manner of theory. God's accounting and the facts are not in conflict, nor is Bereshith Genesis contrary to valid science.
Which is pretty phenomenal. I mean, like, when you read it and you see how everything is plays out, the fact that he did use Big Bang, he talks about dinosaurs.
He begins with light,
exactly. And then how there's all these gases, so he creates plants, and then all of a sudden now there's oxygen, so
right.
All these things can live. And the fact that this was written all those years ago.
3,500.
Yeah, 3,500 years ago written, but yet it still holds true.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah, the thing that you mentioned in the break was that science has had to change its story countless times, always adjusting to what they have learned. And now science and the Torah agree, but if you go back through time, science and at least the religious interpretation of God's creation account in Genesis, they were at the far ends of the spectrum. But yes, laughingly, we can poke fun and say God does cheat. He's not telling of things that he does not know. He was personally there when the universe was created, and all he's doing is telling us, this is what I did, and this is what happened, and then because he is like light, and therefore has already witnessed our future, he can report back to us what will happen in our future without actually predicting it.
Exactly. Yeah, but he cheats, but science cheats. Science cheats more.
And the other advantage that God has, and it's a true advantage, he not only created the universe, but he created the language of Hebrew. And this language of Hebrew was specifically created for a very specific purpose, which was to represent him. The Torah is the most vivid, the most accurate, the most enlightening representation of Yahweh in our world. And the words that it was comprised with, and the very letters that comprise the words, were specifically designed to represent him and to convey this story. So before we begin with the first seven-word introduction, and it's no surprise that the introduction is seven words. Everything that's important to God is seven and is based upon the formula of 6 + 1 = 7. And we will consider why seven is important and read to you Yah's seven-word introduction to his Torah teaching when Shattering Myths returns in a moment. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. Yahweh, which is God's one and only name, begins his open letter to man with a seven-word instruction. It is Barashith, Elohim, Bara, Eth, HaShamayim, Wa'eth, Ha'eretz. In Hebrew, the prepositions and pronouns, conjunctions, are attached to words, and they therefore do not represent separate words. So Barashith is in the beginning. Elohim is God. Bara is create. Eth speaks of a relationship, a connection, a presence between things and an association with things. HaShamayim is the heavens. It speaks of the dual nature of the heavens, both as the spiritual abode and also the physical concophony of stars comprising galaxies. Wa'eth, wa is the Hebrew word for and. It is a conjunction. Eth, again, is this word that presents this concept of a relationship, an association between things. And the last word is ha, eretz. Ha being, again, the Hebrew word for the definite article, and eretz being the Hebrew word that conveys realm. It's land, realm, material. So if HaShamayim is the spiritual realm, the HaEretz would be the material realm. So he created both that which is spiritual, he created that which is material. So that's the initial statement. Barashith, Elohim, Bara, Eth, HaShamayim, Wa'eth, HaEretz. Now, the fact that there are seven words in God's opening statement in Hebrew, where he is communicating what he did, it's a statement of purpose, is no coincidence. Every important aspect of Yahweh's testimony, including his plan of salvation, is based upon the formula of one, representing God who is one, in addition to six, representing mankind, which, as we will learn, was created on the sixth day, equals seven, which equates to not only a perfect result and relationship, but is the Hebrew word for promise. So in this equation, we find God's promise to us to create something that enables God, who is one, plus man, which is represented by the number six, to be together, to be a sum total, which is represented by the promise of seven. Translated into English, the Bereshit in the beginning, Genesis 1:1, reads, in, which is ba, near, with, and in proximity to, regarding the account of the beginning, Reshith, at the start of time, at the initiation of the process of existence, concerning first fruits and the head of the family. The Almighty, Elohim, God, accordingly, F, accompanying an association, created from bara, conceived and caused a new existence, choosing perfect transformation and renewed birth, planning, preparing, and producing ha, the spiritual worlds, shamaim, both the heavens as they relate to the abode of God, and the universe itself, and also the material realm from Eretz, ha, Eretz, matter, the physical and natural world. So in the beginning, the Almighty accordingly created the spiritual world and also the material realm. While I did not have to translate, the dual occurrences of F in this passage, as is customary when rendering Hebrew into English, the word indicates that God was in close proximity to his creation and that he initiated the process of creation for the purpose of accompaniment, of relationship, and of close association. That is what we can learn by including F, since it was written in the introduction. That's what we learn when we consider it as opposed to ignore it. Now, that's important to us because of the fact that once we come to recognize that the creation account is being told from the perspective of the Creator, who was in proximity to, who was associated with, who was there at creation, then we have to apply a different clock to the one we use here on Earth. And we're going to consider that when we begin our review of Bereshith 1:1, of the first seven-word statement that God made in his Torah in our program tomorrow. So stay tuned for an explanation of why relativity is required when understanding this statement.
Many Americans suffer from digestive problems, often totally unaware they're not absorbing essential nutrients from foods and supplements. Dr. Peter Glidden is aware of the